listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. It is media for the rest of us. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman for the first hour and a half today. In that hour and a half, I'm going to have Michael Lofgren with me. He's going to talk about the shadow government that's calling all the shots in Washington, D.C. Investigative journalist David Dayan is going to tell us how banks are snatching up commodities to drive higher prices for consumers. Joshua Holland from BillMoore.com is going to talk to us about the creeping expansion of corporate civil rights. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls at 866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter today at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking. You know, as America gears up for another round of midterm elections this year, there's another secret group that we don't even know about right there in Washington. They're up for re-election in a weird kind of way. Nobody actually votes for them, but they run our government. I have Mike Lofgren, author of the book The Party Is Over. Excellent book. It's just something everybody should read to understand how ugly this story really is. It's a story that you will not hear reported in corporate media. I have to promise you that. Mike, how are you today? Mike, you with me? Well, we had Mike with us, but maybe we'll reach up with him again. Mike, you there? Oh, okay. Let me pick up with while Mike is getting settled there. What we think is happening in Washington, D.C. sometimes is very different from what actually is happening. And what I mean by that is we think that there's a government that we've elected running things. But in truth, we don't have that. We really don't have a government that that we even elect or that we even understand what their involvement is in our day-to-day life. Mike Lofgren's written a great book, and it talks about the shadow government. Mike, you with me yet? Okay. I may have to do this without Mike Lofgren. That's okay. Let me talk about the story. We believe that day-to-day that we have elected officials. We think we have Congress running things. We think we have the Republican Party running things on some days, the Democrats on others. But what Lofgren has done in his book is he's explored who really is running things. It's the Department of Defense. It's the Department of State. It's Homeland Security. It's the Central Intelligence Agency. It's the Justice Department. It's this organic symbiosis that exists all along with Wall Street. Now, here's what I mean by that. As we have struggled with this austerity argument just in the last several weeks, actually we've been struggling with it for years, but in the last few weeks we've seen the argument take place, do we need to cut more services? Do we need to cut more infrastructure? Do we need to cut more school, more education? Do we need to cut the rights of senior citizens, the income of senior citizens? Do we need to leave people out there with any source of money? And while we've been talking about the fact that we can't build bridges, we can't build schools, we can't build roads, we can't correct some of the infrastructure problems we have, we can't build a grid system that delivers electricity all across the country, we can't even correct our water delivery system in this country because the argument is we don't have enough money. While that's been going on, to put this in perspective, the money that we're spending in what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, the best way to get an idea of that, we're spending $1.7 billion in constructing in Utah a group of buildings and a facility that's supposed to spy on everything we do in the country, everything that goes on in the world. And that facility is as large as 17 football fields. If you simply take the contractors and the subcontractors that are working for the government in some form or fashion, if you take the 33 facilities where these subcontractors are working all over the country, they could have enough people in enough space to occupy three pentagons. If we take the money that we're spending on simply having these subcontractors do what they do, we wouldn't have a poverty problem in this country. But nevertheless, the argument is that we have to do without so this organization can flourish. And the organization doesn't just stop with the State Department. It doesn't stop with the Department of Homeland Security or the intelligence agencies of one form or the other. It all, the money goes right to Wall Street. Mike Lofgren, are you with me? Okay,
Hello.
Mike, are you there?
Hello.
Hello, Mike. You're going to have to speak up. I'm talking about your book, and I'm wondering at this point, Mike, you there? Okay, I'm going to have to go without Mike. Go ahead and cut him off. Farron, pick up here if you would, please. If we take a look at what's happening with this military-industrial complex, it has a lot more to do with just spook activity. It has more to do. It has a lot less. It has more to do with the fact that they're shaping the politics of this country. We think that they have to do with just dragnet surveillance. We think maybe they have to do with building prisons that are not sanctioned by the Constitution. We think of them in terms of spying on us without warrants. We think of them having dragnets that bring to bear pressure on all of their enemies. Those are the things we know about. But what we don't know about is what's the connection to Wall Street. And the connection to Wall Street is pretty involved. What really tells the story, I know you reported on this story, where you had General Petraeus, David Petraeus. Now, this guy goes to work with KKR, formerly known Colbert, Kravitz, Roberts. Now, this is a Wall Street organization that makes their money with money. They don't build anything having to do with armaments, but they take their money and they put it behind the armaments industry. If you follow the money in this organization that Lofgren talks about, the money goes all the way to Wall Street, because Wall Street makes money when they devise a new new bomb, when they devise a new way to trigger surveillance, when they build an expansive infrastructure, they make money on that infrastructure. And the David Petraeus story tells you part of that. Here's a guy, he was a general, has no experience whatsoever in finances, has no experience in money at all. But he goes to work for this private equity firm. And people start asking, why? Well, there is no answer to why, because he has no experience in that arena. But you have an organization that's worth about $70 billion that has connections to this structure that Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. But it's not just the military anymore. It's private contractors. It's private contractors that are bringing in money in droves. Farron, we've done a story several times on this. I think people miss the idea of what the concept of military-industrial complex no longer is relevant in the way we used to think of it, is it?
Right. No, I mean, everything today is privatized. These drones that we hear so much about, those are coming from private industry. And as you mentioned with the Petraeus connection to Wall Street, no, he doesn't have any experience doing what he's doing. The thing is, he knows people, and he knows the system. He knows how it works. That's how he makes them money. And any time that, you know, it's time for government contracts to come out or government contracts are announced, their stock is going to shoot through the roof when they get these, because they know they could sell a few more drones. They know they can sell their computer programs that, you know, help track us online. And that's it's all connected. And the main point of Lofgren's thesis here is that these people are not elected. They are there, they're operating, they're calling the shots, and they're not elected, and there's not a whole lot that can be done.
854,000 contract personnel that most of us don't even know about. The money that's paying them is coming from your tax money and from Wall Street. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. I'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ahead, David Dayan, investigative journalist, is going to tell us how banks are snatching up commodities all over the world. It's an ugly story. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom this first hour and a half. Let's go to some of these callers. By the way, you can call me at 866-987-8466. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking about. Ed, you in Chicago. How you doing? Ed, are you there? I'm having real... Ed, can you hear me? All right. Well, Ed's not there. Let me try Jesse in Miami, Florida. Jesse, you there? Jesse in Miami. Are you there? Okay. Well, look, you know, Farron, let me ask you something. As we look at this topic, the reason people miss this topic is it's not something that corporate media actually talks about, because really they're part of the program, aren't they?
They are. I mean, you can watch the corporate news networks and you will see commercials for Boeing. I mean, you've seen Northrop Grumman commercials. I mean, they're getting just as much ad money off this as anybody else. And it's a topic that's, you know, obviously fairly complicated. The average person can't understand it in 20 seconds. And if they can't understand it in 20 seconds, what's the point of us using, you know, devoting any time to it? We're going to lose ratings. Let's go talk about the Duck Dynasty guys for 5 hours because people like that. This takes a certain level of intellect, and people aren't willing to put
it
in effort.
To understand this topic, here's where you have to really focus. What is it that we do without in this country so that this military complex, that, by the way, is not the same thing that Eisenhower was talking about. Eisenhower was talking about a true military complex. That's before we had all the subcontractors come in. That's before the subcontractors, and the numbers are staggering. Almost 900,000 contract employees are working for the government in some kind of spook capacity or another. Now, what does that mean? When Eisenhower was talking about the military-industrial complex, there weren't 900,000 subcontractors working, and there certainly weren't 33 major, I mean mega-size kind of subcontracting organizations that were working on tax dollar money. So what ends up happening? As a matter of fact, the number is really startling. If you took all the employees that simply work by off the books, you know, we don't know who the hell they are. I mean, they've got, you know, Acme Telecommunications Organization. We find out, well, it's a spook organization. If you take all 33 of these that we know about just within the Beltway, you could fill up three Pentagons. Now, that's a staggering number. Now, the other interesting thing about it, go take a look on demographics about where the wealth is nowadays. You know where it is? It's all right within or just barely outside the D.C. Beltway. The wealth disparity is staggering because all of the money has been shifted over to build this complex. And I even hasten to call it a military-industrial complex because it's not what Eisenhower is talking about. Look, Silicon Valley is involved with this. Wall Street's involved with this. Every damn politician, whether they got an R behind their name or a D behind their name, they're involved with this. As a matter of fact, think about this. Senator Barack Obama, when he was a senator, he ran against Hillary Clinton. He said, look, I'm going to run to the left. I'm going to run a campaign to the left of Hillary Clinton, and I'm going to talk about the excesses of war. I'm going to talk about the excesses of how we emphasize terrorism, and I'm going to talk about the excesses of the industrial complex. And you know what? You tell me. Well, you tell me what you've seen happen since he's taken office. Because if you take a look at it, there has been an expansion of that. Think about the fact we still don't know where $12 billion in bills was delivered in Iraq for contractors. These were people that were supposed to be doing contract. These organizations I'm talking about that are part of this new complex. Again, I don't even like to call it military-industrial complex. It is a scam complex. Really, it's a Wall Street complex. $12 billion, we still don't know where the money is as you and I chat right here. Now, let's try these phones again. Ed in Chicago, are you there?
Hey, Pap. May I say it's a privilege and a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks
for... First-time caller.
Well, thanks, thanks, Ed.
Have you heard about what they're going to do with the military, the downsizing?
Tell me about that. I was going to talk about it, but what you tell me what you know.
Okay, from what I've read on the Internet, they're going to cut down the personnel strength down to the size of pre-World War II. It's going to be the lowest we've had in 70 years. And listen to this. One of the reasons they're using, besides cost-cutting, is they say it's doubtful the United States will be involved in another large-scale grand war, large-scale ground war. That is the biggest joke I've ever heard in my life. We've been involved in five large-scale ground wars since the end of World War II. Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq. That's five ground wars in 60 years, one every 12 years, and they don't expect any more.
There will always be wars and rumors of wars. Now, let me tell you the backstory on that, okay? The backstory is Rumsfeld came in to office, okay? Rumsfeld took control of the military. Now, what Rumsfeld did is he took the private contracting industry, Ed, from about something like it was some 15% to where it's now approaching 37% of what happens in our military efforts. You remember Blackwater, right? We contracted with private individuals to be soldiers. We paid those private soldiers three times, sometimes 10 times, what our average soldier was doing for the same thing, putting his life on the line. Now, what's happened is the contracting industry is replacing what we used to call, you know, the solid set military, this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower used to talk about. Now, it's become privatized. So the reason they're saying we're going to cut all these people, all they're doing is giving the money to Wall Street now. Wall Street then goes out and hires some organization there in the Beltway that we don't know what the damn name is. We don't know what they do. They run a spook organization in some office somewhere off of Interstate there. That's where all the money's going. That's why they're going to cut the military. So you are right. That is their intention. 866-987-8466. Give me a call. Let's talk.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Give me a call. Let's have some fun today. Or follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio, 866-987-8466. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio. I've got David Dayan with me. You know, I got Wall Street bankers. They've set up these sites, this new approach. It's the newest scam that nobody's talking about. It's the commodities market scam. They manipulate prices. They gouge consumers. They do it all right from Wall Street. Now, the way they do it is they used to be against the law for banks to go out and buy things like commodities and store aluminum and oil and virtually everything and then set prices according to how they release it and then make money in the stock market by knowing when they're going to release these commodities. But that's exactly what's happening in America today. Matt Taibbi with Rolling Stone did a great job talking about this. And David Dayan, of course, is a regular contributor to the American Prospect. He's been writing about this topic for a long time. David, this is an ugly story. Have you seen it really followed anywhere except in places like Rolling Stone and Mother Jones and things like that?
I mean, pretty much in the business press, it's been limited to it. But as you say, it's kind of an old story. It's kind of a throwback to the days of Standard Oil and vertical combination of the railroads and things like that. If you own the means of production, basically, the warehousing or the refinery capability or the physical commodities, and you're also able to trade on the commodities markets in and speculate in these various commodities, you're going to be able to, by virtue of your knowledge advantage, by virtue of your ability to manipulate the price, you're just going to be able to make a whole lot of money at that.
And, okay, I think it's interesting. You were talking about this long ago. I remember an interview about a year, maybe even longer than a year ago.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking about the effect of the Clinton era legislation, disastrous,
yeah,
that allowed Graham in Texas to do away with Glass-Steagall and say, look, this is a new day, and here's the new day. the new day is bankers aren't really bankers anymore. Bankers can do what the hell they want to do with your money and with the money that's at risk. They can burn it all down like they did the last time. They can buy commodities. They can buy aluminum, for example, and they can store aluminum in warehouses, and they can set the price on aluminum according to how they release it to the market. And then on the back end, they can hustle your stockbroker by knowing 24 hours ahead of time what they're going to do. Your broker is completely in the dark. You're in the dark. They make money on even the back end of that. Isn't that the most obvious? How can you trust the stock market anymore?
Right, or the commodities market. I mean, you know, when you have a situation where prices in the future are more than prices in the immediate market, which is what the situation was during the recession, less aluminum was being used on a day-to-day basis. So there was more money to be made to sell things for future use when presumably there would be more demand for those services than to sell it right now. And the ability to store, the ability to warehouse becomes extremely powerful at that point and lucrative. And so letting Goldman Sachs buy that and letting Morgan Stanley buy that warehousing capability enabled them to make a lot of money on this trade by selling these futures and knowing when they could, you know, time the market basically.
Yeah, well, they're going out, they're buying cargo ships where they store oil. Yeah. They're buying oil in the ground. They're buying
refineries.
Yeah. They're buying gold. They're buying silver. And then here's what everybody misses. If you're a young man in the stock market, now this is commodities we're talking about. You understand, though, this affects the stock market. If you're in the stock market, and you're counting on a corporation that somehow is even ancillarily tied to one of these commodities, then you don't have a chance. You have, how about these people going out and buying gold thinking, well, gee, I've got control over this. This is safe for me. Little do they know that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan and all the big houses, they're trying to control the price of that commodity by going out, buying it up, storing it up. How about this? De Beers in diamonds. Isn't this the same thing? De Beers, isn't this exactly what De Beers does? Buy all the diamonds, put in a big safe, release the diamonds according to when you want, and it affects the price of the diamond, right?
Right. And more than just that it affects the price on the stock market, it affects the price of your beer when you buy it.
Right.
If it has aluminum in the can. It affects everything that is done in terms of when the physical commodities get to market. That price gets passed on to the consumer. So the reason that it costs more for a gallon of gas, the reason that it costs more for a soda or a beer, in part is because of this trading scheme.
Yeah, okay. So as we look at this, I don't see where it's really getting any better because, first of all, you have a Justice Department that's so terrified. I mean, can you imagine the chief police officer in the Justice Department saying, this is just too big for us? We can't do anything about these corporations. It's too big. They can commit whatever crime they want, and we can't prosecute them. We can know they're creating crime, and we can't prosecute them. And right now we know Goldman Sachs is involved in one of the ugliest, the biggest scams that we've seen since they came up with the concept of Glass-Steagall. And we can't do anything about it. So
give you a little bit of hope here. Since Congress trained its eye on this, and particularly Sherrod Brown in the Banking Committee, banks have been a little more reluctant to engage in these practices. J.P. Morgan said that they would sell their physical commodities business. Goldman and Morgan Stanley haven't come out and said that. But there is some more reluctance. Just like anything, it's the sunlight principle. If you shine a spotlight on what is being done, the cockroaches will scurry. So there's an ability to, by more scrutiny and awareness of this thing, get out what's really going on and give banks a little more reluctance as to being able to do it. But as you pointed out, this is a policy matter. The Federal Reserve could change this right now by changing the definitions of what is a complementary business. Because right now, the way it works is if a physical commodities business is considered a complementary business to what banks do, they are allowed to engage in these practices. They could crack down right now, the Federal Reserve tomorrow could put a stop to that.
They won't do it.
That's an important point.
They won't do it, David. I mean, I'm convinced that they won't do it. This is an administration that, look, how do you, it appears at some point that this administration works for Goldman Sachs, whether it's TPP, whether it's the pipeline, whether it's this new concept called complementary activities. That means the bank is not a banker anymore. Any way that they can argue this ties into profit and it doesn't put money, principal money at risk, we're going to go do that. It's unheard of in this country since the New Deal, since you had Roosevelt say this is the kind of parallel, marketing parallel, that will destroy democracy. And it's going on right now, and we have a Department of Justice wholly without any courage.
Goes further back than the New Deal. Goes to Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes, it sure does.
That's... I mean, last I heard, there is an antitrust division in the Justice Department that presumably would be able to also crack down on this behavior, because there's no question that this is trust-making activities. This is very similar to what we saw during the Gilded Age.
David, this is the best example. I think Taibbi might have said this. It's like having a casino in Las Vegas that takes bets on football games, also owning the football team and determining who's going to win the game. It is that outrageous, but you have a Department of Justice, I promise you, you heard it here first. They will not do anything because this is an administration that is owned and wholly operated by Goldman Sachs, by Morgan Stanley, by Chase, by all of the people that we know, we only know part of the story. For example, let's go back to the burn down. The burn down, we heard about the story. We knew the scams were taking place. We knew about the crime wave that took place in Wall Street. And we know nobody was prosecuted. But what you might not, people don't, aren't, they don't remember. They don't remember the LIBOR scandal, where there was one scandal after another, where nobody, our country hasn't done anything about LIBOR scandal. Trillions of dollars involved. Or how about the currency scandal?
Yeah, that's even bigger. I mean, the foreign exchange scandal, that's a $5 trillion
a day
market.
$5.3 trillion a day in the currency scandal. And you know what? We did nothing and continue to do nothing about it. The same thing is happening with gold. The same thing's happening with silver. The same thing is happening with aluminum and now oil and energy. And we have an administration, David, that is owned and operated, unfortunately, in a way that the Justice Department will take no action on this. This is my prediction. They'll take no meaningful action. They may fine them, you know, $400 million, $300 million. Hell, they make that in a day. That's nothing. That doesn't change the way they do business. So in about a minute, David, what's the quick solution here?
The
smartest investigative journalism in the country. There is no quick solution, is there?
Well, you, as I said before, what the Senate is doing and actually shining a light on this is pretty much light years beyond what kind of attention has been paid to this in the past. So,
yeah.
Regardless of where the administration is at, maybe
out of
the Senate, there's enough naming and shaming there that we can put a stop to some of it.
David Dayan, thank you for joining me. 866-987-8466. I'll be right back. I'm in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. I want to take your calls, 866-987-8466. Let me know what you're thinking about. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom. Emails are in, tweets are coming in. Like crazy about the military-industrial complex. The point that I'm making here is it's not what we think of as a military-industrial complex. Diane Mullen says that, yeah, we need to get out of the war game. And I guess the thought is that if we cut military, if we cut the army, if we cut personnel, that we're out of the business. We're not, you see. It would just move the money. We're moving it away from what we used to call a standing army to new privatized army, Think of privatized Army as Blackwater. Think of it as KBR. Think of it as these contractors that have come in. And if you take a look at the numbers, I mean, it's staggering. $2.3 trillion lost. Rumsfeld had no explanation where it went. $12 billion we send to Iraq, and all of a sudden nobody knows where that money is today. Well, we know where it is, don't we? It's with the contractors. That's the new business. When you have contractors taking over the business of war, that's what's happening here, because that's what Wall Street's involved in it. Anytime you have Wall Street, there's going to be a money-making scam. So just because we're cutting down the size of the Army or the Marine or whatever it may be, don't believe that we're cutting the cost of military, and don't believe we're not still in the war game. We've just shifted the money to privatized entities, just like we have with education, just like we have with prisons, just like we have with virtually everything in this country right now. So now that's why we're saying, yeah, we're cutting down our standing army, but it's not better for us. Believe me, it's not better. The trick is to cut out the billions and billions of dollars every month that moves to the private industry of war that Rumsfeld helped create. Let me go to Sarah in Honolulu. Sarah, you there?
Hi.
How are you?
During the Iraq War, I remember reading how they lost the $12 billion, and they described the contractors as playing football with paper sack stuff with money.
Yes.
And I thought, what?
Yeah.
This is what they do?
It's so vulgar, you almost can't even get your eye. You can't, we can't build a bridge here, Sarah. We can't pave our roads. We can't build a new library. We can't pay for schools. We're afraid to pay for working poor, for safety nets for working poor. But we have the story that you're talking about. That's just $12 billion. I mean, that's nothing.
And I'm thinking, my little savings, it's right around $100,000 for all these years that I've lived. What am I to do with that? I mean,
well, 20 years ago, I would say you could talk to your broker and they give you advice. They give you advice, but it's here. You know what? Okay, let me give you the positive. As these pigs at the trough is what they are. They are pigs at a trough in Wall Street. As these pigs at the trough eat up everything, they understand we have to keep something there for everybody else, because there would be absolute pandemonium and revolt if we don't. So the pigs at the trough allow you, an investor out there, that you may have a broker and you're putting money, whether it's tax-free municipals, whether it's some type of stock that pays dividends, whether it's blue chip stock, whatever. The pigs at the trough say, we have to let Sarah in Honolulu have some of this, or the whole system's gonna collapse. So they let you have some, but before they let you have anything, the pigs at the trough gobble up most everything with this system that we're talking about. I got to tell you, go read David Dayan. Just go online, read anything David Dayan's written. The guy is brilliant. Read Matt Taibbi in the Rolling Stone, where he talks about the complementary activities syndrome that the Obama administration seems to be promoting. It was brought to us by Bill Clinton. All right, you had Larry Summers, you had Robert Rubin, you had Penny Pritzker trying to convince Clinton, and they did, that this was a good thing to let banks just do whatever the hell they want to do, because they're going to police themselves, or regulators are going to catch them. Neither one of those things are true. Regulators simply go for the bank. They go to work for the banks. They don't regulate the banks. So you can still make money in the stock market. But what you're seeing, the little increase you're seeing, it ain't nothing compared to what they're seeing in Wall Street, because they got to let Sarah in Honolulu keep something. Let me go to Jerry in Nebraska. Jerry, I got about a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm in contact with Northrop Grumman. And they've spilled a chemical here,
mm-hmm.
called DCE, and it's in the whole neighborhood. They come in and poke 20 holes in the ground.
Yeah.
And they were all contaminated.
Are you in Nebraska, you say?
Yeah.
Have they checked the aquifer? As you probably know, I handled that case up in West Virginia, five years ago.
I've 38 lawyers. None of them will touch it because it's Northrop Grumman.
You can't be. Look, we took on DuPont up in West Virginia. We hit them for $380 million because it was a fight. You got to find the right people, but there are people who do that. And if it's the right case, maybe you got a statute of limitations. Maybe they're afraid of statute of limitations. I don't know what they're afraid of, but the point is this. It doesn't matter whether it's Grumman. I know Grumman is a big presence up that way. It doesn't matter whether it's DuPont. We had, DuPont put armies of lawyers against us in West Virginia, spent gazillion dollars trying to stop us in West Virginia. Bobby Kennedy and I and a team of people said, hell no, we're not going to back down. And we hit them for $380 million, and they cleaned up the site. So, but if it's in the aquifer, Jerry, that's when you have to worry, because that means it's moving through your drinking water and your potable water, and that's a disaster. I'm Mike Papantonio. Give me a call at 866-987-8466. I'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Steve Boss tweets, he says, Pap, it's military-industrial infotainment complex. It's not military. It's Wall Street complex, too. You'd have to add that. It's Silicon Valley complex, too. But it is interesting, the involvement that we see the media show where it comes to war. War's big money for them. I mean, my God, they were so disappointed when we didn't pull the trigger and invade Syria. They were just horribly disappointed. You remember those pictures that they had where you'd have entire studios where on the studio floor was a map of Iraq before we talked about the war. They had it all drawn out for us. It's big money for them. They want us to invade Iran. That's the next thing coming. So it just continues, It's just part. They are certainly part of the war complex. Thanks to Citizens United ruling by corporate Supreme Court, corporations in America, they've been gaining rights as citizens more and more. I mean, the idea of them being people is being taken to the most extreme analysis. They have more rights than citizens. Joining me now to talk about that expansion is Joshua Holland, longtime friend, senior digital producer for BillMoyer.com, just all-around smart guy. Hey, Josh, imagine a guy lives down the road from you. He's a thug. I mean, he's an absolute thug. He steals from the neighborhood. He causes harm to the neighborhood. He brings poverty to the neighborhood. We catch him stealing. We catch him doing all types of horrendous things in our neighborhood. It's murder by poverty. He engages in that. And then he's able to vote. He's able to carry a gun. And he's able to avoid having to spend one day in jail for everything he does. because he's allowed to pay a fine. He pays $1,000 when he brings murder by poverty to your neighborhood. Isn't that kind of where we are with corporate America right now? Isn't corporate America that guy right down the road?
That's the corporate person. You know, the thing is that they have no conscience whatsoever. I mean, it's not even that they're bad actors. It's that they don't have an imperative to worry about social good. So, you know, long before Citizens United, there was this creeping expansion of civil liberties claims by corporate America, started really getting rolling in the 1970s. It goes back to the 19th century, but really since the 1970s, especially this great expansion of First Amendment claims. So long before you had Citizens United, you had the Supreme Court saying, well, you know, you can't regulate commercial speech as much as you used to be able to because of their First Amendment rights to basically lie. And now we're at a point where you see corporations claiming their First Amendment right to practice religion.
Yes.
Just 10 years ago, nobody would have conceived that something like Hobby Lobby, a private for-profit corporation, would ever dream of saying we have a First Amendment right to exercise religion. The exercise of religion is such a human thing, isn't it?
Well, you know, Tom Hartman did a great book. I know you've read it, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And what he does, and of course, I had to study this ad nauseum in law school, but all of this began with the 14th Amendment, which was actually written for newly freed slaves. Had nothing to do with corporations, had nothing to do with fat cats and Armani suits. But now what they've done is they've taken the 14th Amendment and says, what about us? What about us? Aren't we entitled to equal protection in the way that we're handled? Aren't we entitled to have the exact same rights that an individual has? But oh, by the way, you have no right to put us in handcuffs.
Right.
You have no right to put us in prison. Now, we can steal from you, just like the guy down the road, but you don't have the right. We have our 14th Amendment right to due process, but you can't throw us in prison. The case that you were talking about, the Hobby Lobby, we have the same right that anybody has where it comes to freedom of religion. You know, we've proven the First Amendment. We have the right to free speech, and our speech is money. You know, that's our speech. So they've carved out the 14th Amendment. They've carved out the First Amendment. They're now working on three or four other avenues to say that we're really a person. When do we put them in prison, Joshua? When do we put them in prison?
Well, you know, there's that great bumper sticker. It says, I'll believe that corporations are people when Texas executes one. Nowadays, you're seeing this really perverse thing where private companies are claiming a religious right to discriminate against real people. Flesh
yeah.
and blood people.
Yes, yes. Talk about that. That's a real nuance. Talk about
so
it.
This is something that just failed to pass in Kansas. It's passed the legislature in Arizona and may or may not be signed into law. It says that basically private companies, and in the case of Kansas law, it was also public employees, could refuse to serve gays and lesbians as long as they said it was because of their religious beliefs. And this is kind of grounded in the idea that any business can practice religion. So if you're, you know, if you do wedding photography or whatnot, that's an exercise of your faith.
Mm.
One of the proponents of this thing said all work is ministry. And I mean, that makes no sense to you and I, but that's the basis of this argument, and it basically turns the rights argument on its head, right? So we've seen gays and lesbians really make a very compelling argument that they should be treated equally under the law, and here comes the religious right saying, no, it's you're basically infringing upon our rights when
yeah.
you claim that when you claim your rights.
How about this? You even have now, think of how crazy this is. And this is you have a Supreme Court, you understand, that is grasping and expanding on every chance. Every time a case comes to this Supreme Court where it expands the right to treat a corporation as a person that we can't put in prison when they kill people with dangerous products, when they destroy people, poison people by way of toxic pollution of our waterways or our air, when they make drugs that they know are going to kill people, but they like the profit margin, so they do it anyway, when they steal from mom-and-pop pension programs because it's simply profitable to steal, when they do these things, you have the Supreme Court looking for every kind of way to say, yeah, they're a person, they just happen to be a psychopath. They are a person, but they happen to be a psychopath, and we can't put the psychopath in a mental institution, and we can't put the psychopath in bars for the criminally insane. We can't do anything for the psychopath. Now, the latest thing is they're trying to say that the Fourth Amendment is violated when we have the Department of Justice or any kind of law agency trying to take aerial photographs of operations where they're polluting the waterways, where they're polluting the air. You're not allowed to go fly an airplane and take pictures of that because it is you're violating my Fourth Amendment right to search and seizure.
Well, now, that hasn't flown. But the thing that you need to...
No, it will. I'm telling you, it will fly. I promise
that's
you.
The important thing to understand, especially with this Supreme Court, is that it's really a slippery slope. And what was inconceivable a generation ago is something that they will really stretch the law to find some justification for. I wonder if the next thing isn't Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination.
Ah, very good point. Well, let me just tell you something. Now, you just say that you said the Fourth Amendment issue, it's not over. I can tell you there's a couple of cases working their way up in issues of mining cases where the only way you could find out about the destruction of mining was to take satellite photographs. Fracking, we're going to see it again. How did you get this material about what's put into the fracking stuff that's injected into the aquifer that's killing people or poisoning people or destroying entire neighborhoods? When you start getting there, you're going to have the Supreme Court saying, you know, this is a person. You remember what we said. They have a First Amendment right by way of money. They have 14th Amendment rights. We're going to give them these rights, too. Joshua Holland, thank you for joining me. This story could not be any crazier, but it's true. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. I'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. Tom will be back in the last hour and a half. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. Let's go to some of these callers. First of all, Jesse in Miami. Are you there, Jesse?
Yeah, hi, Mike. Thanks for what you and Tom all do. Hey, I got this solution idea. The problems usually don't get solved unless you go to the root of it. So how did the 1% become the 1%? You there, Mike?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, well, they basically, you know, they just like the slave owner claimed by all rights he had the ownership of a slave, a guy has the idea of inventing the wheel or inventing the English language. They figure anything that comes from it, they're the king. So that's where we are today. So
well, it's interesting. That. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that you use that term, the slave mentality. That's used more and more now to describe the way that you have still not just U.S. industrialists, European industrialists, Asian industrialists. They understand that there's part of any culture that is perfectly okay to take advantage of. In other words, if you can squeeze another dollar out of the workers in Saipan, those workers are put on earth to be taken advantage of. They're there for a reason. It's a philosophical concept that it's not new. It's been around for a long time, but it's not much different from that slave concept. And that is they believe there are the haves and the have-nots by design. If you take a look, for example, of the Confederate establishment pre-Civil War, what you will see is that those people felt like they had a God-given right to do what they did. God gave them the right to be prosperous. God gave them the right to take advantage of other people. God had blessed them in their mind. If you take a look and do some serious reading about how they justified all that, it was that they were ordained by God, that they were the leadership class ordained by God. And they take it all the way back to the early days of the Old Testament, as a matter of fact. Then you compare. Let's just make a comparison. Go north of the Mason-Dixon line, and you had the industrialists during that period of time, big money up in the Northeast. Now they had the same kind of awful things they did in the way that they made their money, but they felt like they had some kinship to the community. Their notion was they were philanthropists that felt like they had to build schools. They had to build roads. They had to improve the living standards for the people around them because they felt like if they did that, they did better. So there was this really, and it still exists. In the South, you still have that slave mentality. But I'm here to suggest it's probably more than just the South. It's probably, we see it all over the world right now. It's the us and them mentality. Johnny in Texas, are you there?
Hey, Mike.
How are you?
Hear you. I appreciate, I know a lot of people appreciate your straightforward, no-nonsense style of the way you conduct yourself on the air on your show.
Somebody just wrote me, so may I cuss too much. My apologies. Sometimes I do. And
I can't hear anything you say because I'm on Magic Jack, which is their answer towards economy.
What's your question?
If they charge you a little bit, they don't owe you a damn thing, so it's like a walkie-talkie.
What's your question?
My question is a legal technical one. I'm thinking that when we get robbed, when the house gets robbed, you call the police, they come out, take a report, or you go down to your local police station to file a report on someone, or if you want to sue someone. What's to prevent me or several private citizens, tax-paying citizens, from going to a local field office of the FBI up in New York and filing a complaint and wanting to swear out some kind of arrest of something against some of these Wall Street these criminals, they're basically criminals. They steal, they get away with it. Why can't we hold them accountable like you do the local robber in a small town?
Let me answer that. Okay, here's the answer. First of all, you have to be – there's something that's called standing. Okay, standing is – it's a concept that's devised and it says who is the person that has the right to proceed with a criminal proceeding. Now, obviously, they're very clear on things like a felony or a misdemeanor. There are things that you can complain about, and you can swear out a warrant. You can give the information that should give rise to a warrant. Unfortunately, the reality is I used to be a prosecutor, and it's going to be very tough to walk in a prosecutor's office and say, I want to accomplish what the Department of Justice is unwilling to do. I want to accomplish what Eric Holder says he's incapable of doing, and I want to accomplish that by swearing out a warrant. And here's my vehemence of the warrant. Here's what I think happened. And it, as a practical matter, Johnny, it's just not going to happen. The infrastructure's there, except for sometimes there's a standing issue. Are you the right person to do that? Are you the right organization to do that? Are you the person that's been directly harmed? And so you'd have all kinds of problems in that regard. But the real problem is a political problem. This is an administration that simply doesn't have the heart to go after Wall Street. Steph in Wisconsin, very quickly. Steph, are you there?
Yeah. Mike, nice to hear your voice. Regarding Freedom of Information Act, could that be used to follow the money, whether it's going to Iraq or to Wall Street or to the NSA, to find out what corporations are getting funds from the feds? And how much?
Yeah, let me answer that question. I use Freedom of Information all the time to sue corporations, to sue the government. As you might know, I handle whistleblower cases all over the country. And those are people that have inside information. And I'll typically take their information and I'll our attorneys, the team that does this, will formulate a request for Freedom of Information. What is remarkable is if you get 10 pages of information that really is relevant information through Freedom of Information. The new thing is redaction, where they simply take a big black marker, they mark through everything, and if you get 3 words on a page, that's a good thing. Now, 10 years ago, they weren't on to that. But right now, they say, well, there's this privilege, it's confidential, there's some way that they avoid giving you that information. I'm Mike Papantonio. I've been in for Tom Hartman this first hour and a half. Tom's going to join the next segment. So thank you for your time. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I'll talk to you later.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio. I've been with you for the first hour and a half for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'd like to know what you're thinking day to day.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And thank you, Mike Papantonio, for filling in for me for the last hour and a half. I had some stuff I had to take care of here in town, and it's taken care of. So I'm back, which is good. All of that kind of stuff. So anyhow, by the way, tip of the hat to the folks at KBCS who sent us hats and bumper stickers and a Valentine. They're doing their fundraising drive right now. And it's really I've lost my – I was going for another email here. Anyway, and X-Ray FM is carrying us now. And greetings to our newest affiliate in Portland, Oregon. X-Ray.fm is their website, and we are so pleased to be on with you. Okay, so this is what I'm looking at the news today, and I'm seeing what I think are really two huge stories that you need to know about and that we all need to be talking about. And my guess is, my prediction is, that you will not hear either of these stories, which I think are the two most important stories in the news today. You will not hear either one of them discussed in any kind of depth, and probably not at all, by the corporate media tonight, including the so-called progressive corporate media. So that said, let's just, you know, cover them. The first has to do with the death of the Internet. You'll recall a couple of weeks ago when the district court or circuit court, which is it? It's the D.C. Circuit. That's right. The old judges used to ride the circuit back in the day when they were also on the Supreme Court. Okay, the D.C. Circuit Court, this is the Court of Appeals, the one step below the Supreme Court, knocked down net neutrality and said, you know, Internet service providers – in other words, the people who carry the web into your home, that connection point from the backbone, from the giant tubes that run across the country and between cities, from there to your house, the FCC can determine that they're a common carrier. In other words, they basically gave the FCC a little more power. They said the FCC can determine that they're a common carrier, and they have to just let anybody through who wants to in the same way. Just like they've said phone companies are common carriers. So if I get a call from Shane or if I get a call from Danielle, the phone company can't say, well, you know, Shane called you. That's an extra dollar and a half. Or they can't say to Shane, you want to call Hartman? It's going to cost you an extra buck and a half because we know that you talk fast. And Danielle talks slower, so, you know, she's cheaper. I mean, this is really how it works with common carriers. A common carrier, you can't charge based on what's in the package, right? UPS is a common carrier. They can charge based on weight or size. In other words, you can charge based on how many bytes somebody's using or bits, which has always been the case, but you can't, or how much time they're using, but you can't charge based on what's in the package. UPS doesn't pick up a package and say, diamond necklace from Tiffany's. We're going to charge $45 to deliver this. Swimsuit from Walmart. We'll deliver that for a buck and a half. They don't do that. They're a common carrier. Common carriers cannot discriminate. The post office is a common carrier. Trucking companies are common carriers. They can't charge you more to move your furniture across the country if you've got fancy furniture versus not fancy furniture. I mean, you can pay more for insurance, but in terms of just shipping the stuff, there's a flat rate, more or less. So there's a range of rates. And, the same with pretty much anything. So common carrier rules, you got this. The FCC said, or excuse me, the Supreme Court, or the one step, the D.C. Circuit Court, one step below the Supreme Court, said the FCC can decide that Comcast or Verizon or AT&T or whoever you happen to get your internet from is a common carrier. They can decide that, or they can decide not to decide that. And the FCC decided not to decide that. Tom Wheeler is the chairman of the FCC. Before that, he was the head lobbyist for companies like Comcast. And before that, he was the head lobbyist for companies like AT&T. And he made $19 million doing that.
And now he's running the FCC. And so, gee, what a surprise. So Comcast is trying to buy Time Warner, and even without Time Warner, they're huge, and they already own NBC and MSNBC and NBC Universal and all that stuff. And everybody was wondering, you know, and we were talking about it here, Netflix is being slowed down on some networks. One of the people who works in this office has Fios from Verizon, and they've been slowing down Netflix over the last couple of weeks. So I was wondering, you know, is Netflix going to get on our side and petition the FCC to say ISPs are common carriers? They cannot discriminate against Netflix. I mean, the fact of the matter is, for somebody right now in D.C. using, according to, actually, I shouldn't use this as an individual example because it's just an individual example. But, you know, somebody who has an ISP that has decided that they're going to slow down Netflix, because Netflix accounts for about half of all the non-pornographic content on the web. And right now they're saying, basically, we're going to slow you down if you're watching Netflix, but we're not going to slow you down if you're watching porn. So I was waiting for Netflix to say, wait a minute, that's wrong. We're going to sue you. Instead, what Netflix did is they went to Comcast and they said, well, who knows what they said. This is my guess as to how this thing went down. Something like, you know, Comcast, you guys are the cable TV business and you're also the biggest internet service provider in the country, or will soon be the biggest by and large. The biggest is buying roughly the second biggest. We see that you are moving the internet into a cable TV model. Now, a cable TV provider, if I'm CBS and I want to be on the air in the New York City market, I have to pay RCN, I have to pay Verizon, I have to pay Comcast. I don't know what all the companies are that provide internet service in Manhattan, you know, that have licenses and agreements and have wires running under the buildings and through the streets and whatnot. But basically, you have to pay each one of them to be on that cable system. And so the cable company says, okay, we're going to open 120 channels on our cable system. And, $500,000 a year, $1 million for the first 20 channels. The next 50 channels are $750,000. I have no idea what the numbers are, and I guarantee you they're a lot larger than those numbers I just quoted. But basically, you pay to be on, you know, on one of the cable channels. And so Netflix goes to Comcast, in my opinion, and says, we see that you are turning the internet into something like cable TV. We would like to be channel one. We want to be the first channel. We want to have the fastest speeds of anything. We want it so that when somebody downloads Netflix, they're going to get it faster than when they download porn. And so Comcast says, cool. Instead of running you through the backbone, through these big backbone companies that carry internet traffic along with, you know, all the porn and everything else. And I say porn not because I'm obsessed with porn, but because it actually, depending on whose statistics you're looking at, represents somewhere between 10 and 40% of all the content, all the web content going on right now. So it's huge. But this is not about porn, but you get the point. There's pretty much not that much other. Well, YouTube. I mean, you know, it's Google owns YouTube, and so pretty soon they're going to have to cut these kind of deals. Except that people don't watch YouTube for 5 hours during the day. They may watch YouTube for 4 minutes or 6 minutes or 10 minutes or maybe an hour. Although increasingly people, now that YouTube is starting to get into the streaming business, our show's available on YouTube as a continuous stream. Increasingly, as YouTube gets into this business, they're probably going to have to go to Comcast and say, okay, here's some money. Deliver us fast, too. We want to be channel two. And then Hulu is going to come along and say, we'll be channel three. And so what's going on here is basically the barriers to entry are getting really, really high. When I was a kid, you could start an FM or a UHF television station And I know two people who did this. You could start a UHF television station with about a $10,000, $15,000 investment back in the 60s. The barriers to entry were virtually non-existent. Anybody could start an FM or a UHF TV station. It was really, really simple. There was lots of bandwidth. It was widely available. You had a lot of entrepreneurs who started out, and that's how a lot of these cable channels now started out. They started out as UHF TV stations up in the high bands, channel 27, you know, band channel 27. And then they morphed into, over time, the Food Channel or the Discovery Channel or whatever. You know, the UHF station got a place on the cable system. And then once they had a place in the cable system, they got bought out by a network. And then the network, you know, reinvented themselves four times. And they went, you know, and now they're MTV. And I see the same thing happening on the Internet. And the cable companies make it on both ends. They get paid to carry the stations, and then they come to you and they say, we will give you 25 stations for $39.95 a month, but if you want MSNBC, it's going to be an extra $5. If you want HBO, it's going to be an extra $10. In some cases, they share that money with the network. In other cases, they don't. Depends on who's getting packaged with what and how. And that's what's next. That's the next shoe that's going to drop. I predict it's going to take about a year. And they're going to come to us and say, oh, you want streaming video? Well, that's an extra $10 a month.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The net of this is that this is the death of a garage-style business. Entrepreneurs, forget it. It is now a business for oligarchs only. And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you 15 minutes before the hour. I'll tell you what the second story is at the top of the hour. We're going to get to that. The second big story. In fact, we're going to have, I'm going to rant about it a little bit, and Shane Farnan is going to come on and tell us a little bit about it, which should give you a clue, those of you who are regular viewers, what the topic is. But these are the two big stories in my mind. And so, anyway, Paul in Woodinville. Hey, Paul, thanks for watching or for listening. And I'm putting you right at the very beginning of a 5-minute break instead of the end. My apologies for last Friday.
Okay, I should have been ready with something shorter to say because you never know when how much time you have. But I do have something kind of short to say here. Papadonio, Mike Papps was talking about the laws in Kansas and Arizona that were allowing people to discriminate against gay and lesbian couples if they were to say, you know, not serve them in their businesses,
right,
if they were to say it's based on their religious beliefs.
Right.
Did you hear that segment?
I did not. No, I was otherwise occupied, which is why Papp was filling in for me.
Okay. Well, I thought of something, and my segment is called Two Can Play at This. South Carolina recently passed a law that says that they're going to have now the Confederate flag on their on the upper right-hand corner, I guess, of their license plate.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to remind you of a call you had, I don't know, it was several months ago, and you asked a guy from, I don't know, he was from the South. You said, do you think that the Confederate flag is a symbol of racism? And he said, no, sir, I do not. But you went on, and I was going, Tom, ask him, what does it symbolize then?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't think of what it symbolizes other than a war against America and racism.
Well, I can tell you, having lived in Atlanta, having lived in the South for 13 years, I think, altogether, that for many of those people, it just symbolizes this is where we're from. I mean, I count among my ancestors on my mother's side of the family, James Madison, who was a slaveholder. And but that doesn't mean that when I look at James Madison's home or whatever, that I'm thinking, gee, I'm proud that I'm, you know, the descendant of a slaveholder. I'm actually quite embarrassed by it. But So the U.S. flag was Madison's logo, and that's just, you know, that's just. So I think for some of these guys, it really doesn't mean racism. I think for the ones who are most out in front of the topic, though, it very much does.
I think most African American people would consider it a symbol of racism. And
yes,
as a Northerner, I mean, I was born in Michigan, as you were.
Yes.
By the way, my great great grandfather Henry Milner was a prisoner at Andersonville Prison. Is one of the few that escaped, actually, walked all the way back to Michigan in 1864 or 60, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, so for our family, and the horrors of Andersonville, you know, are certainly something that I mean, to me, the Confederate flag, if people want it down there, want to say that's where you're from, I'm asking, but where is that? Where is it? Where you're from is from the state where you live in. Yeah. But where you're from psychologically, when you say the Confederate flag is where you're from, to me that means what kind of thinking is
I absolutely get what you're saying, Paul. And like I said, I think for a lot of people it is absolutely what it means is they're from the South, they're from the white South, they're from the white Southern culture, and there is a racist edge to it, and particularly if they're gonna shove it in the face of a black person. But there's also some small percentage that it's just, hey, I like the, you know, talking with a funny accent. Paul, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And Victoria Jones with a talk radio news service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com on Ratner's charity. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's great to see you. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, in the Ukraine, Russia stepped up its rhetoric against Ukraine's new Western-leaning leadership. Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, who I think we can safely say does not brush his teeth in the morning without clearing it with Prime Minister President Putin first, said that interim authorities in Kiev had conducted an armed mutiny. He said that the legitimacy of a whole number of organs of power that function there raised great doubts. Some of our foreign Western powers think otherwise. This is some kind of aberration of perception when people call legitimate what is essentially the result of an armed mutiny. And that's some of the more mild language that he used.
Well, the fact of the matter is, Victoria, that
yes.
The, what's his name? I want to say Yushchenko. Is that the name of the president?
Yanukovych?
Yeah, thank you. He was democratically elected by a majority of the people.
He was indeed.
So, you know, I mean, if the Canadian prime minister had been overthrown by a mob in the streets, what would you call it?
Well, you would call it that. He went on to say that a forced change of power was taking place. He also accused the interim leaders of passing new laws aimed at infringing the humanitarian rights of Russians and other ethnic minorities. Now, he didn't point out what those laws were. What is, I think, of concern to some Russia watchers is that this could be pointing towards Russia leaning towards taking some further steps. Yeah. Other Russia watchers are saying probably not so much that Ukraine is not Georgia, which, Russia ended up with a couple of pieces of Georgia after its unrest. And Ukraine has a pretty well-organized military itself, and that Russia might not want the Crimea, which is in the southeast part of the country and very much leans Russian and has been also having demonstrations pro-Russia.
Well, and
it's thought to be where Yanukovych is right now.
Yeah, and let's not let history get rewritten. Those two parts, the South Ossetia and Afghanistan, or however you say it, Misha Saakashvili sent his troops in there before the Russians reacted. He provoked the Russians.
Correct.
And John McCain acts like it's the opposite. And McCain had been there 4 months earlier, meeting with Saakashvili, and this was during a presidential election. And McCain tried to use this against Obama to demonstrate that he had no foreign policy chops. And then as soon as this was over, McCain got $1 billion, no strings attached, to Saakashvili as a gift through Congress. And Saakashvili then, you know, when he left power, he had to basically flee his country. He's living here in the United States as a college professor and doing very well, thank you very much. The whole thing stinks. And I don't see any of these as black and white.
There's
particularly
nothing
black the Ukraine and white situation.
About There very rarely is. There
but it's like, you know, now that we've got, you know, several American institutions who have been meddling in that country, as well as obviously the Russians meddling in it for a good long time, but it's right on their border. I mean, you could argue we meddle in Mexico. This does not lend itself to simple.
With the transition of power, the protesters are quite impatient with the people who, even in the interim government, are being driven up to parliament in Mercedes and BMWs and have aides who are with them and have bodyguards, and they're saying that, you know, this is basically the same as the old.
Right. Meet the new oligarch, same as the old oligarch.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is not what they want. And there's a question of how patient will they be if things don't change. And then, of course, there's the whole other question of Ukraine's gaping economic needs and whether Russia is going to pay the next tranche of money to Ukraine as part of its bailout, or whether it's going to withhold it. And it's not at all clear that it is going to.
Yeah.
Now, the White House said today that Treasury Secretary Jack Lew conferred today with the IMF's Managing Director, Christine Lagarde, on how best to provide assistance. He telephoned her. He also spoke yesterday, apparently, when he was at a G20 summit in Sydney with the Russian finance minister to talk with him about the economic situation. And there's very grave concern about Ukraine's economic situation, which really is perhaps not being talked about as much as it should be, because that is the pivot of all of this.
Yeah, they're looking at 45% inflation right now. I would strongly counsel the Ukraine to be very, very wary of the IMF, because the IMF has already said that if they make a loan to Ukraine, it's going to be contingent on Ukraine basically embracing neoliberalism.
Interesting. Interesting.
They're going to end up like Greece. But
that's not good.
Back to you.
Secretary of State today, John Kerry, demanded that Uganda repeal its new anti-gay law that was signed by the president today, and warned that the State Department's begun a review of U.S. assistance to the impoverished East African nation.
Right. Now, are we doing this with Good Luck Jonathan, too, in what's the country? Was that Nigeria?
In Nigeria?
Yeah.
Interestingly, my understanding is that there may be a review.
Because Nigeria supplies us with a hell of a lot of oil. So I'd
exactly.
be, you know, so all of a sudden it's like, we don't care. I mean, the Saudis have laws like this, and we don't mind that.
Well, there have been calls for a review of U.S. aid. I don't know whether there has been a review of U.S. aid, but there is a review of U.S. aid in Uganda.
Yeah.
So
it's like we're going after the low-hanging. I mean, I'm as outraged as you are and everybody else is and should be by Uganda passing this law. I'm also outraged that countries like Saudi Arabia have had laws like this in the books forever and routinely execute and imprison gays. And we say not one word.
Yeah.
Pardon me. But
yeah.
For the editorializing, I realize this is our news
politics.
Segment. Back to you for the news.
No, it's your show. There's
yeah,
politics,
thank you.
And then there's real politics.
Yes. And I think we should be talking about the bigger picture from
indeed.
Time to time as well.
The nation's governors met with President Obama this morning and emerged from the meeting claiming harmony. And then Bobby Jindal immediately said that Obama seemed to be waving the white flag of surrender over the minimum wage. And he was attacked by Connecticut Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy for doing so.
The fight is engaged.
Back down.
Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOwlGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As I mentioned in the last half hour. I think that there are, and again, thank you. Great thanks to Mike Papantonio for filling in for me for the first hour and a half of our program today. I think that there are two big stories in today's news that are, in my opinion, two of the biggest stories in the world that will not be covered by network news tonight and probably will not be covered by most all corporate news, and that you need to know about and you need to be sharing with people. And the first was that by Netflix deciding that they were going to give Comcast a whole pile of money to make sure that their data goes through faster so you can watch your Netflix movies faster on Comcast, basically the door to entry into the internet business, at least for people who are streaming large quantities of video, has been closed. Forget about being a startup company in your garage. Forget about, you know, beginning a company in your basement that does anything on the web that requires a lot of bandwidth. The internet service providers now have not only the power to come to you. I mean, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia made that decision. Not only have the power to come to you and say, pay up, buddy, if you want your stuff to go through fast, but by Netflix saying, okay, fine, how much? Here's the money. We'll write the check. Netflix and Comcast have established now a cable TV model for the internet, and Channel One is Netflix. And pretty soon, you're gonna see Google pay for a channel. Pretty soon, you're going to see Hulu pay for a channel. Pretty soon, you're going to see anybody who's putting a lot of video through the internet having to pay for channels. And what that means is that if you've got a great idea to start something and you want it, you know, you want to do it, you're going to have to get in bed with an oligarch. You're going to have to do it on Google, or you're going to have to do it on YouTube, or you're going to have to do it on Netflix, or you're going to have to do it on Hulu. You just can't do it yourself anymore. And this is only going to get worse over time. Mark my words. We now have the cable TV model for the internet. And I believe that to be a very bad thing. It only benefits the oligarchs. So that's the first big story that I don't think you're going to see on TV tonight. This is not only the death of net neutrality. This is the total corporatization of the internet in the United States. Now, this is not happening in Europe. This is not happening in South Korea. It's not happening in Japan. It's not happening, to the best of my knowledge, anywhere else on Earth, although I'm guessing that the second, you know, the middle world countries are going to start doing something like this as quickly as they can. It's like, you know, good ideas, that is to say, ideas that make money for oligarchs, for big corporations, spread fast. Just look at the banksters. The second biggest story for the day is kind of a twofer. One, big headline this morning, actually, on Huffington Post was, you know, regulate quickly, or words to that effect. And it was about how President Obama has come to the conclusion after 6 years of banging his head against the wall that Congress is never going to do anything to cooperate with him. They're not going to allow him to pass any legislation of any consequence. It ain't going to happen between now and 2016. As long as it might happen after 2014 if the Democrats hold the Senate and take back the House, but that's extremely unlikely, given the gerrymandering that was done in the 2010 election, after the 2010 census, as a consequence of the 2010 census. You now have Republican congressional districts. You know, you have states like Wisconsin where it takes, and South Carolina, where it takes 2, 3, 4, in some cases 5 Democratic votes to equal 1 Republican vote in terms of electing members of the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives from those states. It just ain't going to happen. They have rigged the system. So Obama is saying, okay, screw it. I'm not going to try and get stuff through Congress. I'm just going to go it alone. And the only way he can go it alone is with regulation. And so he says, we're going to start, you know, using regulation to get things done. Cool. If you're serious about that, Mr. President, please consider aggressively regulating carbon dioxide. Here's why. CO2 levels are now higher than they have ever been in the history of our species on this planet. Humans, fully modern humans, emerged around 165,000 years ago, and during that entire period of time, CO2 levels have never gone above 400 parts per million, and they are now. Which means we are going to soon, and we are at the very leading edge of it right now, encounter environmental conditions, weather basically, weather and oceans, the movement of air and water, driven by temperature. We're going to encounter these things that our species have never had to confront before. This is a very serious time. We're starting to see this right now here in Washington, D.C. Bitterly cold day today. It's down around 40 degrees. It's going to get down to 16 or 19 degrees on Thursday. That's not normal for Washington, D.C. in March. Turns out the Arctic, first of all, this is the fourth warmest January in the history of the world, as far as we know. We've got some pretty good historical records. It's also the fourth lowest amount of ice cover in the Arctic. And what's happened is that the circular river of air called the jet stream that flows around the top and bottom of the Earth, kind of like the edge of a yarmulke sitting on the top of the planet, you know, a little hat sitting on top of the planet. That was always kept in place by the temperature differential between the mid-latitudes where you and I live, or where most of us live, where I'm sitting right now, the mid-latitudes and the polar latitudes. There was that difference in temperature created basically a barrier, a wall of difference in pressure and temperature that kept the jet stream way up in the north. And occasionally it would dip down to the point where it would touch Minnesota, you know, Frostbite Falls or whatnot. But that, you know, is pretty rare. Now, because the Arctic has been, over the last two months, on some days, 27 degrees warmer than it's normal. That wall of air has collapsed, or is collapsing, is in the process of collapsing. And so the only thing that's restraining the jet stream now is geography, mountains. The jet stream just kind of drools down, and it hits the spine of the Rockies in Alaska, and it follows the Rockies all the way down to New Mexico, and it brings behind it this cold polar air. So on the eastern half of the United States, where the jet stream has drooled all the way down to Georgia, you've got air that literally was in the North Pole a week earlier. And to the west of the Rockies, you've got air that was closer to the equator last week that's being sucked up. And this is why you had 71 degrees in Anchorage. Well, what this is doing is it's increasing the melt rate in the Arctic, and now we're starting to see large quantities of methane bubbling out of the sea, the Arctic Sea. And nobody knows if this is just, you know, melting permafrost or peat, or if this is melting methane hydrates. But if this is melting methane hydrates, then we may have already started a tipping event, a tipping point event that may be irreversible. And if we haven't, we need to stop now. So, Mr. President, if you're going to use regulation, use the EPA to impose severe penalties for exposing. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Severe penalties for dumping carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. Put a price on carbon, please. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul in Lucerne, Texas. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to comment about our tax system?
No, I'm watching on Dish TV. That's all I watch.
Great. Well, thank you.
Okay. I wanted to talk about America's been dumbed down. When my dad helped me with my homework and my mom helped me with my homework, they said, that's what they're teaching you? I did the same when I helped my children. And we've been dumbed down for a while now. And it's kind of scary because we've had this similar situation in history. I call it the Gilded Age, most people do, where we had runaway wealth. And the way we dealt with it was the tax code.
Right.
That's how we put the brakes to it right away.
That's right.
And I'm not sure America is smart enough to realize that.
I think that Americans are starting to wise up, but I think that you're right. We realized that the last time because of the Great Depression of 1898 and the Great Depression of 1929. And following both of those...
All those people who went through that are dying.
Yeah, those people are dying and dead. But we're now in the Great Depression of 2008. And frankly, or at least the Great Recession of 2008, Obama caught it pretty quickly and fixed it to some extent. But I think it's going to get a lot worse. And when it does, then people are going to wake up.
Started in the 40s.
Pardon?
The Great Depression started just like this. It was a Great Recession that turned into a Great Depression. So we're not nowhere through this.
Yep. No, that's my point. I just wrote a book about it that essentially says that.
No. I saw your lecture.
Yeah. So do you have a proposal for going? I haven't been able to. I have been on this radio program for a decade now, for 10 years, longer than I've ever done any one thing in my life. And, trying to wake people up and say, it's time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. It's time to roll back the entire Reagan revolution. And we're making some progress and we're getting some voices and people are starting to wake up, but it's nothing close to the kind of critical mass that you need in society. And now that, we have this very, very corporatized media and increasingly we're going to have a corporatized internet, I see it, basically that the only thing that's going to really cause people to wake up is when the pain hits them in their pocketbook.
Well, I believe we could wake people up by explaining to them in simple terms.
And those would be?
Well, basically like you're trying to talk to a fifth grader.
Yeah. Well, it's very simple to say, to explain that, when tax rates are above 50% after you make your first couple, $2-3 million a year, then people keep their money in their businesses and they don't take huge salaries out. And whatever they have that they're saving for their retirement, or for their estate to pass on to their children, they're very careful in how they invest it, because that's money that was very dear to them. On the other hand, when you drop taxes below 50% after you make $2 or $3 million, then hot money, easy money gets into the system. And people start making $10 million, $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion. You had a dozen guys on Wall Street last year who made $10 billion or $2 billion each in 1 year. And they just start throwing that money at stuff. You get all this hot money. What happens when you get hot money in an economy? You get bubbles, and then eventually they burst. And so you have cycles of the economy looking great and then collapsing and looking great and collapsing. And it just keeps going until you fix the damn tax code. It's time to roll back the Reagan Revolution. Paul, thank you for the call. I'm with you. Spot on. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Shane Farnan is with us. He is not only the associate producer for this program, but he's also the Supreme Court reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And which of these Twitters should I put out, Shano?
Probably Talking Left or the one for Talk Radio News.
Okay. All right. Because I've got two here that don't look like either one of those. But. Okay. Shane Farnan, you are a law school graduate. You know this stuff. You were over at the Supreme Court this morning.
Mm-hmm.
We hang out every single day and talk a lot about these kind of things. But today, I just did a rant about how important it is that the president regulate carbon dioxide, because Congress isn't going to, because Congress is owned by a bunch of oligarchic billionaires who make their money and have their assets in carbon. They're sitting on billions of dollars worth of gas and natural gas and coal and oil underground, and they make their money with that by refining it and transporting it. And they own Congress, both the House and the Senate. And so you're not going to see a carbon tax any day soon. That the president needs to use the EPA to literally save not just our planet. I mean, the planet will go on without us, as the old George Carlin routine, but to save the human race. And interestingly, this topic was debated before the Supreme Court today, at least in part.
Just this morning, there was actually extended oral arguments for an hour and a half about the EPA and whether or not, you know, the president has gone around now saying he's going to use his phone and his pen. And the EPA has a lot of discretion to regulate carbon. There was a case back in 2007, Massachusetts versus the EPA. And back then, it was the George Bush EPA. And it was a bunch of states that sued the EPA and said, you need to start regulating CO2 and greenhouse gases, et cetera. And the Supreme Court said yes in a 5-4 decision, said yes, the EPA can regulate greenhouse gas emissions. It listed out six of them, among them carbon dioxide.
Now, was this in the face of the Bush administration saying, no, mm-hmm. you can't regulate them?
This was the EPA saying, we're not going to.
Okay, so the
EPA said, no, we're not going to. And the states, states like Massachusetts, California, saying, you need to.
So the Supreme Court at that time essentially ruled against the conservative ideology of the day during the Bush administration.
Exactly. They said it's time to regulate greenhouse gas.
And I don't remember when Elena Kagan or when Justice Sotomayor came onto the court. Is the bench basically identical?
It's interesting. It was a 5-4 decision in 2007. The four dissenting justices are still there. Thomas, Alito, Scalia, and Chief Justice Roberts.
So those are the four who wanted to say that the EPA cannot regulate carbon dioxide.
Exactly. They are still there. So we're already walking in saying four of these justices are going to rule against the EPA. In this case, and the EPA now has gone ahead and said, okay, we're going to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And this case has to do with extending in the Massachusetts case from 2007. It was the EPA, you should regulate the emissions coming out of cars' tailpipes, essentially, you know, engines, car engines, vehicles, et cetera. Right. Now they've gone ahead, and the one that was the situation that's before the court today was the EPA has said, if you're going to build a new power plant, or you're going to augment a power plant, if you're going to expand any new construction or how you run these new power plants, you need, under the permitting process, you need to get a permit from us, the EPA, and you need to follow certain guidelines in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. They've been challenged by industry leaders, a certain number of states, like led by Texas, saying that this is too much, that EPA has gone too far. They don't have the authority to do this.
Right. When you hear conservatives scream about, you know, job-killing regulations, this is typically what they're screaming about because this hits the Koch brothers in their pocketbook.
And they really, they've been on a jihad against the EPA for a very long time. It's highly political. So you already have four justices that are probably going to say, yeah, they don't have the authority to do this. Even Chief Justice Roberts, they pointed out that he was in the dissent on that case. So Kennedy was in the majority. Kennedy is still there. The two justices that have moved, David Souter and John Paul Stevens. David Souter was replaced by Sotomayor. John Paul Stevens replaced by Elena Kagan. So those votes will not switch either.
Right.
So yet again, it comes back to Justice Kennedy.
Kennedy is the swing vote once more.
Yes, but remember, he was on the side of regulating greenhouse gas emissions. He made a point. He didn't speak a lot today, but he made a very strong point that the Massachusetts case that is still binding, that they must file the rule, and he said the reasoning of that case. This court is bound by that. So I found that as a positive sign.
So was he making that? Was he saying, basically, I was right then and I'm right now, or was he saying that is stare decisis, that is to say established law, and therefore this court should not mess with it, even though I'm the one who made that law?
He's saying the court should not mess with that. The greenhouse gases are still under the authority of the EPA. We're not going to change that here today, at least not by my vote.
So that seems like it might be good news.
I think it is good news.
Might be another.
If I were to be forced to predict,
when is this going to come down?
Oh, you never know.
It'll be in the fall?
It will be before the end of the term, which is the end of June.
They
never tell you exactly when they're going to bring out a ruling. The only ruling you know are the last day because they haven't ruled on it yet. And they know so it could come at any time. I would assume it'd probably be somewhat later, in that it'll be the 5-4 decisions tend to come later
because there's all this political backfighting going on in the background.
There is. So
very, very.
Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor were strongly in favor of this, giving. Justice Kagan called it, this is the apex of deference that should be, you know, given to the EPA. Justice Scalia was still just as strongly against the regulation.
What's the basis of Scalia's objection?
That it goes beyond the text of the statutes, that they're just grabbing too much authority, that they've actually rewritten the law. Because when Congress first enacted the Clean Air Act, It applied to 250 tons per year. And when it comes to
tons of what?
Exactly. Tons of what? Air pollutants and how that is defined.
Right.
And CO2, they've had to move the number because lots of, a Dunkin' Donuts, as they said in court, can emit that. So the EPA has actually raised that level and therefore, in some say, rewritten it. The Solicitor General said we're in a transition period. Right. So do they have the authority to rewrite that law?
Right.
Or
times change. Do we yeah. have...
Because Congress in 1977 didn't anticipate greenhouse gas as right. something that's even a problem. They didn't know about it.
Right. Interesting. Maybe we need new legislation as well as, although...
if you can get this Congress to do it.
Yeah. That would be...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thank you. That was Shane Farnan. He's the Supreme Court reporter with the Talk Radio News Service and the associate producer of the Tom Hartman Program. Glad to have you with us, Shane. Good, the bad, and the very, very geogenically ugly, the good. Rocco's Little Chicago Pizza, after the Arizona legislature passed a bill that would allow restaurants and other businesses to discriminate against gay people, the Tucson pizzeria decided to give the lawmakers a taste of their own medicine. So they placed a sign in their window warning all lawmakers who try to enter that they reserve the right to refuse service to Arizona legislators. Rocco's owner, Anthony Rocco DeGrazia, told the Huffington Post that he decided to put the sign up because, quote, opening the door to government-sanctioned discrimination, regardless of why, is a huge step in the wrong direction. End quote. I couldn't agree more. Let's just hope Arizona Governor Jan Brewer is listening and vetoes her state's newest discrimination bill. The bad. Stacey Flanagan, the Fairfield, Connecticut resident, has made herself the enemy of waiters and waitresses everywhere by using tip money to pay for her meals. According to police, Flanagan, quote, stole a tip jar from the counter. Then, while the cashier was distracted, she stole money from a different tip jar to pay for her order. End of quote. Flanagan's behavior would be a little more understandable if she were desperate for cash, but she's apparently quite wealthy. In fact, Fairfield Town records show that her house is worth well over $1 million. So basically, Stacey Flanagan is a rich person who pays for her lifestyle by stealing from working people. Yep. She is modern American life in a nutshell. And the very, very ugly, Rex Tillerson. ExxonMobil CEO is all in favor of fracking, that is, until it might affect the value of his $5 million Texas mansion. According to the Wall Street Journal, Tillerson has joined a lawsuit that is trying to block the construction of a water tower near his Texas home. That water tower would supply water to a fracking site that is close by, and according to the lawsuit, would create a lot of traffic and noise. Tillerson's lawyer said that his client joined the lawsuit specifically to protect the value of his home. Fracking hurts the values of homes all across the country, and while it's nice, I guess, that Tillerson finally understands that, his hypocrisy is very, very ugly. That's mind-boggling. Is Rex Tillerson still the CEO of United Mobile, or ExxonMobil? I'm pretty sure he's the guy who bears a striking resemblance to Fat Bastard from the movie, that's not Rex Tillerson. That's the previous guy. Yeah. Yeah, okay, he's still the chairman. And he's thin. Okay. I can't remember that guy's name. Lee Raymond. Yeah, Lee Raymond. Go on the internet sometime and look a picture of Lee Raymond. And what was the name of that movie? Austin Powers. Yeah, Goldfinger or whatever it was. One of those Austin Powers films. Oh, it's hysterical, the resemblance. I mean, it's just... Anyway, I hope he's a public figure. Ted in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Ted, thanks for watching us on YouTube. You wanted to comment about common carriers, the FCC, that sort of thing?
I suspect I know why the FCC doesn't want to go down the common carrier, and it might be for a much more pragmatic reason. In the early days in phone technology, the phone lines were limited to something like 2300 kilohertz, which is when they digitized it, 56 kilobits per second.
Right.
so everybody had the same level of service.
Right.
Corporations can tie PBXs together with something called a T1 line, which was intended to be 56 kilobit per second times 23 voice channels.
Right.
That's how corporations had tie lines from to avoid long-distance phone charges. Even when you look at broadcast TV, not until HDTV came along, the standard of quality was exactly the same. So here's the question. If the FCC was to declare the Internet providers a common carrier, define common in terms of quality. I think that's the next question that they would have to approach, and they don't want to go down that path.
Well, here's where common actually becomes defined. There would be two thresholds, two potential bottlenecks. The first would be, and in the United States it's the exclusive one, the first would be the capacity of that company to provide data to you at a particular speed and you know, your willingness to pay for it, presumably. So, you know, your ISP may have the ability to provide you with 10 MIPS up and 100 MIPS down, and or you know, 100 and 500 or whatever it may be. Or they could negotiate with you as we do. I mean, if my home internet is considerably slower than my internet here at work because we pay for much more bandwidth here at the radio studio. And so there's that bottleneck. But the other bottleneck, which exists in South Korea and in most European countries, would be if, you know, that, now that bottleneck could be, and in most cases would be, a mechanical bottleneck, basically the capacity of the equipment to handle data. The secondary bottleneck would be which internet service provider you choose. In France, for example, where you can, for $35 a month, get 100 MIP high-speed internet and plus your telephone service and free calls to, I think it's 29 countries, plus 100 plus channels of cable television, all for $35 a month. The reason for that is because whoever brings the wire into your house or the fiber into your house, they charge a certain amount for that, and they make a small profit on that. So they charge like $11 a month to bring that into your house. And then you go out and you shop for an internet service provider, for a phone company, and for a cable TV company. And you have, you know, dozens of them, and in the case of internet service providers, more than 100 of them competing with each other in France and in South Korea. And in I believe this is the case in Japan. You have a bunch of different companies competing with each other to provide that to you. And different ones will have different capacities in terms of their ability to deliver to and through a backbone and to and through your physical internet service provider in your physical area. So, for example, when I lived in Vermont and we had a law like this that had to do with telephone carriers, Verizon found itself having to rent its telephone lines to Sovereignet, which was Vermont used to be a sovereign nation before it joined the country, so everybody likes to use the word sovereignty up there. So it was the Sovereignet, the Sovereign Vermont Net, and Sovereignet.com. I think they're still in business. And they, for $25 a month, you know, Verizon was charging something like $30 a month for residential telephone service, plus this, plus that, plus this, plus that, plus if you wanted somebody to come out and see you at your house, you had to make an appointment 3 days in advance. And Sovereignet said, we're just going to serve a small area in Vermont, and the service guy will live six blocks down the road from you, and it's $25 a month flat rate. And we were Sovereignet customers for a long time, and in fact all the lines coming in for our callers on this show, when we used to do our show out of the living room of our house, which is where we started this program 10 years ago, were on Sovereignet. And if I had a problem with anything other than the copper, the Sovereignet guy, and sometimes the copper that was inside my house, the Sovereignet guy literally lived two blocks away from me, and he would walk over to our house. He helped us wire our first what's called a hybrid. It's the system that allows me to put callers on the air. And so am I making sense?
Yeah, you are. And I remember I lived in England for a short time, and British Telecom had to do the same thing. They had to basically lease their wires to local providers.
Based on the customer's preference.
Right. And they would provide the last mile service.
Right.
Actually, I think that would work here in the U.S., but trying to change this huge industry into that level of
well, that's how it used to be. That's how it used to be. I mean, I back in the 80s, I used to run forums on CompuServe. In fact, I made a pretty good living doing it, and along with a bunch of other people who worked with me, who are still working with me, Nigel and Sue and a bunch of other people, several of them are still working with me. And basically, you accessed CompuServe over your telephone line. It was dial-up service. And you could choose between CompuServe or AOL as your internet service provider, basically. And AOL, you know, carpet-bombed the world with free disks, and everybody joined AOL. And CompuServe got acquired by H&R Block, which decided to simply suck them dry and take all their profits. And CompuServe went out of business, and AOL's still around.
Yeah, my only issue, though, is I don't think the FCC or even Congress is going to be able to turn the clock back and go back to those type of arrangements.
I agree. That's why I'm saying this is the biggest news story of the day, because the FCC is not going to change it, because their chairman Tom Wheeler made $19 million as a lobbyist, first for the telephone companies and then for the internet companies, and right. He's now the fox in charge of the chicken coop. He's not going to change it.
So here's one other question. Suppose I don't know if this can be done with the common carrier rules, but suppose that the last mile connection is negotiable between the service provider, would be Comcast or Time Warner or whoever it is, and the customer. But once it's in their network, they have to take a hands-off attitude.
Well, that
so that my access to Xfinity and my access to Netflix would be exactly the same.
Well, then you're talking net neutrality. I mean, that's basically net neutrality, is right now they're claiming the ability to inspect what's coming in. This is they're making the deal with Netflix. Eventually, they're going to come to you and me and say, we want to also be able to inspect what's going out. And I'm confident that that's the case, because I know right now when I use a virtual private network, they cut my speed. So they're getting ready for it. Ted, I'm out of time, but thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's why I think that isn't going to happen. You're going to see tiered pricing for Internet access. So you want basic access? Oh, you want streaming video? Oh, you want the porn channel? Oh, you want the news channel? Yeah, extra price, please. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Libby in Seattle, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Libby.
Hi, Tom.
So you wanted to talk about where to go. Oh, corporate personhood.
WOMAND, our citizens' initiative campaign to overturn Citizens United.
Move to amend.org.
State.
Yeah. So tell me what's up.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that we're now gathering petitions and signatures, I should say. It's going great guns. We've got almost 3,000 volunteers who've joined us. And we're all over the state, and honestly, Tom, everywhere we go, we are just met with huge enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you, and John Nichols, when he was out here, said he was encountering this all over the country, but it's really true that people all over the state are so dedicated to getting this done
mm-hmm.
that it's easy to get signatures, and it's fun, and people are very passionate about taking back their voices.
Well, that's great.
So I just wanted to let you know, now that we're a couple of weeks into this campaign, how well it's going.
I spent about a half hour earlier today with Ralph Nader, and not on the air at all. He was being a guest on Larry King's show, and I was going to be a guest on Larry King's show, and so we were in the same television studio together and just hanging out, waiting to go on the air. And just, you know, chewing the fat. And he was like, we were talking about corporate personhood, because he's a big fan of my book on equal protection, and I'm a big fan of everything that Ralph does. And he made the point. He's got a book coming out in April, and I don't think I'm breaking a confidence by revealing this. I think it's probably, you know, out there, but he's not going to be doing media on it. In April, he'll be on our show talking about it. But he's got a book coming out basically about how the folks on the, quote, right
the Tea Party right and the folks on the, quote, left, the progressives like you and me, are finding that in areas like net neutrality, in areas like corporate governance, in areas like corporate personhood, in areas like free speech, in areas like privacy, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, right to assembly, First Amendment, in all of these areas, we're finding that we have more in common than we have in opposition to each other, and that these alliances that are, you know, bringing right and left together, really genuine activists on the right and genuine activists on the left, together around issues where we agree in common, are going to, over the next few years, become the most powerful political force in American politics outside of the billionaires, and maybe in opposition to the billionaires. I thought that was a fascinating premise. So
absolutely.
And that's move to amend.org. And one of the things I find most fascinating about that is that David Cobb, who is kind of the road show for Move to Amend, you know, he travels around.
Right, I know David.
Yeah. He has been going out of his way to contact Tea Party groups and get himself invited to speak in front of their groups, and they are loving him. You know, they're totally on board with him. And this is one of those areas where I think Ralph has identified, Ralph Nader has identified, that are so spot on. So, Libby, thanks for listening to KBCS. Thanks for your call. And most importantly, thanks for joining MoveToAmend.org and being part of the solution. We all need to be that. Libby, thanks so much. Great talking with you. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is weird. I just got I've mentioned many times I subscribe to the Financial Times, and I'm really not trying to promote this newspaper. They don't pay us for advertising or anything. And I mean, if they did, it would be a whole different thing. We would then give them ads. Let's not go into that. In any case, I just got this, you know, I get this email from them once a week that kind of summarizes what's going on. And this one article, FT Magazine, Simon Cooper on why plonking the government in central Glasgow, that'd be Scotland, where male life expectancy is 54, could transform British social policy. What does plonking mean? It's a Britishism. Oh, geez, I came in late and I don't have the chat room open. I'm going to have to get that up and running so I can ask Sue. Anyhow, all that said, let's get back to your phone calls here. Matt, listening on AM 760 in Denver. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Dom. Big fan of the show. I'm a big fan of your books.
Thank you.
Anyway, I just wondered why one of the smaller companies, or for that matter, even one of the bigger internet companies, couldn't stick to the principles of net neutrality and advertise on that.
Well,
say if they start jacking up your prices, then switch to us, and we'll even...
Because they don't own the wire coming into your house. What has happened is that the cable TV companies, there's basically only two ways to get data in and out of your house, and that's through a cable TV line or through a telephone line. And the telephone lines just don't have the bandwidth capacity. So you can't run high-speed internet. The best you can get is DSL. And that's really, really squeezing every last little bit out of it. And
right.
So for high-speed broadband, basically it's got to be either coaxial cable, which is what, you know, cable TV runs over, or fiber. And there is a technology to move data and a lot of data over power lines. But again, that runs into those same bandwidth problems that you have with the telephone line. It's just two copper wires, and you get, you know, they're not designed to prevent radiation from as high speed data runs over a wire, it's basically at radio frequencies, and it'll start radiating out from wires. Coaxial
right.
cable's got a grounded shield around a hot wire in the center, and so it's able to confine that field. And of course, fiber is just, you know, it's light moving at the speed of light. And so whoever owns that, what's called, what a previous caller referred to as the last mile, that's the jargon in TV and cable and telephone service. It's not literally the last mile. For somebody living in a remote area, it might be the last 70 miles. In somebody in a city, it might be the last 45 feet. But whoever owns that connection from the backbone to your house or to your particular
Couldn't the corporation that owns that use that as an advantage and say we're going to remain loyal to net neutrality and,
They could, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, AT&T...
They're going to make more money the other way?
Yeah, they're going to make more money the other way. I mean, why would Comcast do that when they already have you by the short hairs, basically? They've got the wire going into your house. They've got the coax going into your house. You're in some parts...
Down to the monopoly.
Yes, exactly. It's all about monopoly. And that's why I'm suggesting that the last mile should be negotiable. I don't have a problem if Comcast or Verizon or, you know, fill in the blanks, if they're running the last mile wire into my house and they have costs associated with that, you know, maintenance, installation, everything else, I don't mind paying them, you know, $10, $15 a month, whatever the actual cost is plus a profit for them to run that into my house. But the data that goes over that last mile, that should not have to be theirs. But the way it is in most states, and I believe now increasingly this is becoming federal policy, is that they get to decide we own that data too. And so we can decide what data gets sent to you, as in, you know, going to Netflix and say pay up if you want fast delivery. And we get to decide what kind of data you are going to get. In other words, if you want streaming, if you want to watch a lot of video, you're going to have to spend an extra $20 a month. If you want to visit the Huffington Post or the New York Times, you're going to have to add another $5 a month. If you want to go to your favorite porn sites, it's going to be $30 a month. If you want to go to the Weather Channel, it's going to, you know, whatever it may be. They've got these different, you know, and these menus, my understanding is, are already being basically, you know, marketed, gamed out. So that's the problem. Michael, thanks for the call. I really think this, my concern about this is that the last way that we are organizing democracy, the way that, for example, Move to Amend is organizing people all across the country, is via the Internet. And when the Internet becomes purely a commodity rather than an information commons, and if you have common carrier rules, then it is a commons. That's where the word common comes from. The information commons becomes privatized, and as that happens, we're going to see the same thing happen to the Internet that we've seen happen to television, radio, and movies, frankly. Is that the potential marketplace gets much, much smaller and the barriers to entry get much higher. David in Victorsville, California. Hey, David, we've got a minute to the end of the show. It's yours.
Well, Tom, I'll just take this minute to compliment you in the impressive way in which you hold all of this information in your head.
Well, thank you.
And dispense it and, and share it with the public.
I have crib notes.
Oh, do you not?
I do.
You're truly a patriot.
I wrote this stuff down.
I'll just say this in light of some of your writing about Reaganomics. Well, Reaganomics kids have been birthed, and I think what we are fighting with today is all of these giants that have pretty much corrupted our political system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to compliment the lady who called in on Move to Amend.
Yeah.
Because if we don't take money out of politics, I don't know if we've already passed the tipping point.
Right. I'm with you. If we don't get money out of politics quickly, we are toast. What we have right now increasingly is an oligonomy. In other words, an economy dominated by oligarchs. And that is very quickly moving to an oligopoly, which is a form of government that is dominated by oligarchs. And I don't think we want to go down that road. I mean, that's one of the big problems that you're facing in the Ukraine right now, is meet the new oligarch, same as the old oligarch. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, of course, all the news and information you won't hear in the corporate-owned news media and your calls. And I've got a couple of rants for you tomorrow, queuing up. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get active. Get out there and occupy something. Tag yours.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection.
Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.